You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of July 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Tom Edwards.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's time for us to set the day's news agenda with Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin.
Plus...
And with individual profiles, it's one great tablet designed to be shared with the whole family. You just might not want to. Introducing Nook HD, the world's best 7-inch tablet for reading and entertainment at Barnes & Noble.
Is the largest chain of bookstores in the United States on the verge of being broken up as Barnes & Noble reshuffles its top table? We'll look at how the bookseller is trying to turn its fortunes around.
And later in the program, we'll be treading the boards.
To be or not to be? That is the question.
One of the questions we'll be posing to the author of a new book, which claims to have unearthed the golden rules of acting.
All that plus, we'll be checking in with one of our correspondents around the world. We'll also leaf through the Brazilian front pages, and we might even play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So a very busy 60 minutes coming up ahead, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Egypt's interim president has named the liberal economist and former finance minister Hazem el-Beblawi as prime minister in a transitional government. State television announced his appointment as the authorities try to steer the country towards new parliamentary and presidential elections after the army ousted the Islamist president Mohamed Morsi last week. The state broadcaster also announced that the United Arab Emirates has offered Egypt $3 billion of support for the economy. And Saudi Arabia has also approved $5 billion in aid. US State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki says they welcome and support Egypt's transition to democracy, but they know it will take time.
We've, of course, seen the announcement coming out of Egypt. As we have conveyed to all of Egypt's leaders, we want to see an inclusive government that addresses Egypt's many political, economic, and social challenges and builds, as well as building a greater consensus. This is part of the transition. They also announced, of course, additional steps regarding a constitution and elections.
Officials investigating the Asiana Airlines crash at San Francisco Airport say the pilot saw trouble when the plane was at 500 feet. The National Transportation Safety Board says the pilot realized the Boeing 777 was off center and tried to correct its course as it approached the runway. Two Chinese teenagers were killed in the crash and over 180 people injured. Two flight attendants were thrown from the aircraft after it lost its tail when it struck a wall. NTSB Chairwoman Deborah Hirstman has visited the scene of the crash.
When you get down to the seawall, you can identify where the first strikes took place. First, the main landing gear impacted the seawall, and then the tail. You can see pieces of the cabin, sections of the cabin, that are found very early on in the debris field. You can see aircraft parts, galley materials, newspapers, magazines, and flooring.
Canadian authorities have opened a criminal investigation into the freight train disaster which killed at least 15 people in the town of Lac-Mégantic on Saturday. Police say they found evidence to suggest that the train's brakes may have been tampered with while it was at an overnight parking spot, causing it to roll several miles downhill into the town, where four cars containing crude oil exploded, destroying dozens of buildings. At least 35 people are still missing. Relatives of those still unaccounted for have been asked to provide items which could contain DNA samples like toothbrushes, hairbrushes and razors. China has warned of a grim outlook for trade as the world's second largest economy surprised financial markets by reporting a fall in exports and imports when both had been expected to rise. The figures, which follow a government crackdown on the use of fake invoicing that had exaggerated exports earlier this year, are likely to raise fresh concerns about the extent of the slowdown in the economy and global demand. The data for June showed that exports fell 3.1% from a year earlier and imports dropped 0.7%. Peter Maguire, chief market strategist for Asia Pacific of Baxter FX, says the figures aren't a surprise.
as far as global demand, that seems to be softening. And of course, with Europe in the position that it's been in, and it's just protracted, you know, slowness to a point of nearly negative growth across the whole, you know, the whole zone. It's not surprising. And I think that there could be a further softening over the coming months and continue with this downbeat. I'm looking for where we're going to see the growth. Certainly soft in Australia and I think across pretty much most of the world at the moment.
Italy's highest court has set the 30th of July as the date for hearing ex-Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's tax fraud appeal, much earlier than expected. The Court of Cassation acted on the day the appeal was formally lodged. Analysts say the early hearing could prevent the statute of limitations from expiring on one of the charges. An appeals court upheld Mr. Berlusconi's conviction in May. It also reinstated a 4-year jail term and 5-year ban from public office. The British broadcaster Channel 4 has become the first commercially funded public service TV station in Britain to air the Muslim call to prayer every morning during the month of Ramadan. Despite criticism, the channel says it's right to give a voice to the country's Muslim minority, which has faced a backlash since the murder of a soldier on a London street. Dr. Omer Alhamdoun, Assistant Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain, says it's an excellent idea.
It's very significant. First of all, in Britain, we're living in a multicultural society. And to acknowledge that Muslims are part of this society and to give them that kind of belonging by actually airing the call of prayer. So we very much welcome it.
There's the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed. Barney, it's just ticking towards 7 minutes past the hour, 8:07 a.m. here in London, and you're with Midori House here on Monocle 24.
And yes, you are listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Tom Edwards. Well, it's time now for us to set the day's news agenda with the three stories we'll be keeping our eyes on throughout the day. And to do that for us today is Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Ben, many thanks for joining us here in the studio. How are you?
Very well. Thank you very much for having me.
Good stuff. Where should we begin today? Should we begin with China?
Yes. It used to be an old joke that the moment America caught a cold, economically the world sneezed. Now, very much the same thing can be said about China. And in the past 10 years, we've seen the amount of countries for whom their key trading partner is China overpass the amount whose key trading partner is the US. And you see China now being the country that swathes of South America, Central Asia, Southeast Asia, chunks of Africa are economically dependent on. So the big question, I think, to watch out over the day and weeks to come is, what does this slowdown in China mean geopolitically? How many regimes, industries that regimes are dependent on are going to start wobbling as Chinese demand, Chinese exports begin to falter?
Ben, it's interesting, isn't it? That's obviously the concern as we look forwards. But I mean, if we look back to what's actually behind this, I mean, obviously, some people would suggest, I suppose, that the overall growth rates, it's not that grim a reading. You know, it's down a couple of, it's down what point, maybe 0.2%, but it's still downward. What's behind it? Do you think it was overinvestment during boom times? Is that the kind of the real reason behind the problems we're seeing now?
Well, I think so. It's like in business, what matters is the trend. It's what people will plot their profits and loss, their projects on. And you saw in the past 15 years, key global industries like shipping, pipelines, factories invest gigantically in oversupply of capacity. Way too many ships, way too many factories. And a lot of these are now going to be sitting idle. And this is a big question for key foreign Western investors. What are all these extra ships going to be doing? It's going to drive down the costs. It's a key question for countries like Russia that have just signed giant oil and gas deals with China. And it's a big worry overall for issues like the oil price. What does less Chinese demand mean for long-term projections of what China's economy will look like in 5, 10, 15 years? Thus, assumptions of how much oil the world will need.
Do you think there's an opportunity, though, Ben, here for two particular countries, Japan and the United States? Both have been seeing economic rebounds, especially Japan, its exports climbing astoundingly over the last couple of months. Is this an opportunity for those two countries to really reassert their economic dominance, perhaps?
In a sense, yes, but that doesn't answer your problems if you're Russia, Central Asia, or South American raw material exporters. These raw material exporters, the prices of raw materials had been massively inflated based on the assumption that China would be growing at 10, 11, 12% forever. The Japan factor and the US factor was already priced into the market 10, 15, 20 years ago. So it's not very reassuring if you're a Kazakh dictator to sort of wonder what the price of oil will be in 15 years.
Ben, also interestingly, obviously within China, the policymakers are trying to, well, they've tried it to some kind of offset some of the declines that they've seen in exports by boosting domestic consumption, but they've not really been able to do that. I mean, are there that many options left for the actual administration in China, or are they just slightly hostage to fortune with this?
Well, one of the key problems in China is the vast shadow banking sector that exists and how far China can go with liberalising its banking sector whilst exposing the party and the power structures to public scrutiny and losing control over the sinews of cash pumping through that economy. So the Chinese leadership is facing kind of very uncomfortable policy decisions over the next year ahead.
And Ben, all eyes continue to be on Egypt to see what's going to happen in that country. During the Muslim Brotherhood's rule, Qatar was a big donor to Egypt, but now it looks like the sands may be shifting slightly to two others.
Yes, competitive aid. And Qatar, thanks to its gigantic oil and gas windfall, managed to go all in on all the games of high stakes in the Middle East, all in on Syria, all in on Egypt. And it bet very heavily on the Muslim Brotherhood, huge amounts of aid, lots of very suspicious dealings with key figures around Morsi, and lots of rhetorical support and media support through TV coverage, selling the revolution across the Arab world. Now, the political situation has changed in Egypt. You see Saudi and the UAE suddenly pumping in aid to Egypt, trying to buy influence and buy access to the new government that's forming there around the military Mubarak era hangers-on and new kind of revolutionaries and Democrats are coming up from the street. So is this the beginning of the end of the Qatar moment in the Middle East? Probably a little too early to say, but certainly it's going to be less influential in Cairo than it was 6 months ago.
Ben, it's interesting, isn't it, looking at this, the dynamic in Egypt. Obviously, these Gulf states have welcomed the army's manoeuvrings in Egypt. Other countries have been, understandably, in some cases, very reserved about it. Turkey, notably, very unhappy. What do you think? I mean, if you look at the situation in Egypt, do you think this is something where we're looking at a descent, a spiralling into continuing chaos, maybe a civil war? I mean, what's your kind of early reading, just looking at the big picture?
Well, kind of to use another China-themed joke for the morning, is that Zhou Enlai was famously asked what he thought of the French Revolution, and he said it was too early to say. And I think the consequences of what's happening in Egypt, of both the gigantic boom in public space, so much new media, so much new voice, so much new activism going on one hand, and also this very kind of painful to and fro between mob politics, the street, anger, you know, huge questions of whether or not political Islam, old military elites, democracy can coexist in one state. I think we're many, many months, probably years off knowing what the reckoning is there.
And Ben, finally, let's move up to Russia. Alexei Navalny, the leading opposition leader, has assembled 100,000 signatures. Tell us what for.
Alexei Navalny has found a new way to outfox Putin. Mr. Putin had promised that if anyone could gather 100,000 signatures, a particular issue would then be sent to his rubber-stamp Duma, completely controlled by Putin's United Russia Party. And one of the first people to do it was, unfortunately for Putin, the opposition leader, with a petition saying that officials should not be allowed to buy cars on the public budget worth more than $47,000. And Navalny has gathered lots of documentation showing that officials have been buying cars for over $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. And he's very successfully secured a kind of populist campaign, managed to gather the signatures almost overnight. And Putin's going to have a big problem answering this.
This is also the same man who's currently on trial for embezzlement, isn't he?
Well, he's on trial not only for embezzlement, but much more importantly, standing up to Putin. And Russia doesn't either have a functioning civil service, as these sort of stats about cars would indicate, doesn't have a judicial system either. Like, the judiciary in Russia is a tool of Putin. And Navalny's verdict in his trial will come in June the 18th at 9 a.m. We will know whether or not this man will be spending the next 6 years in jail or not.
And we'll be reporting about that right here on Monocle 24. Ben Judah, thanks very much for joining us. As always, that's Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell in and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin.
Coming up, we'll get the latest on troubled times for US bookstore Barnes & Noble. That's all right after this.
The Globalist Asia is our brand new show covering global stories, but with a focus on what's shaping the business day from Beijing to Bangkok, Singapore to Sydney.
My vision of the Japan, how I see with this, I mean, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan.
There are also fresh insights from our global network of correspondents, contributors and editors, including a survey of the Asian front pages.
We're going to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So tune in to The Globalist Asia every weekday for your global news digest. That's The Globalist Asia at 3 a.m. in Hong Kong, 4 a.m. in Tokyo, and 6 a.m. in Sydney. Brought to you in association with GE.
And welcome back to Midori House. The U.S. book publishing giant Barnes & Noble, like many of its competitors, banked on the rise of e-books and tablet publishing to bolster itself against America's shifting reading habits.
Introducing Nook HD, the lightest 7-inch HD tablet with the best screen for reading. Magazines, books, and now movies look better than ever before.
Well, it's a gamble that hasn't really paid off. The company's CEO, William Lynch, left his post on Monday with immediate effect. The company's stock rose at the news, but the past few months have made for some grim reading for the company's investors.
Sales of the Nook, Barnes & Noble's e-reader, have all but crashed. Sales in the Nook fell 34% last quarter. Losses doubled to $118 million. Well, what lies ahead, therefore, for America's largest chain of bookstores? And what can it do to meet the increasing pressure from its competitors? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Philip Jones, editor of the Bookseller Industry website. Philip, many thanks for joining us here on the program. Is this as bad as it sounds for Barnes & Noble?
It is very bad, and it's been bad for a few years, really. They've not really managed to leverage the Nook, the growing Nook business, into a profitable one. And the last quarter of fiscal 2012 was disastrous. At Christmas, the biggest time for device sales and for content sales, they managed to see sales plummet. So I think William Lynch has paid the price for that.
So, I mean, tell us, Philip, what do you see? Is there a kind of an overarching theory then emerging in amongst big book retailers about how to balance this old and well-documented clash between, you know, traditional retail and the digital marketplace? Are people kind of learning by doing? Will people, I don't know, all around the world be looking at Barnes & Noble and be sort of trying to learn the lessons of this latest attempt?
Yeah, I think up to about 18 months ago, there was a school of thought that the Barnes & Noble strategy of kind of combining digital reading with an in-store experience that also sold you print books was the way forward. Waterstones in the UK has pursued a different strategy. It's given its digital business to Amazon. It sells Kindles in-store, and it concentrates on its kind of retail store and concentrates on selling physical books. I would have put my money on Barnes & Noble 18 months ago, but now it seems that the Waterstones strategy is the one that pays off. Going for that still quite healthy print book market and having nicely curated stores. I mean, the problem with Barnes & Noble was that it took its eye off the physical side of the business. Its retail stores were not selling print books particularly well anymore. They were too focused on the digital experience. And I think that creates a double whammy. The digital reading experience now is all but a battle between huge sort of tech giants, Apple, Amazon, and Kobo, which is owned by a huge Japanese firm called Rakuten. I think they're the sort of three main players now. I think it's incredibly hard for a traditional business to get into that space.
Because the key thing here really is that demand for books is still up. According to figures last year from British publishers, sales in 2012, total spending on printed and digital books were up 4%. Digital spending rose by 66%. So those are very promising figures, aren't they?
Yeah, there was a slight 50 Shades effect in those numbers. I mean, when you get a huge book like that, it does tend to distort them. But I do see more growth in this market. The problem is that it's growth in the numbers of books being sold, the numbers of people reading it. It's not necessarily growth in the value of those book sales. The transition to digital is usually at a sort of quite a big revenue cost. Digital books sell much more cheaply than print books. So although more people are reading, it's not necessarily growing the overall business. I think that's a big concern. The chief executive of Hachette UK, the second biggest publisher in Britain, said to his authors just last week that he saw this as a long-term declining market. I don't agree with that, but I can see where he's coming from. From a traditional publisher or bookseller point of view, it's an incredibly difficult period.
So, Philip, let's talk then about the actual physical bookstores. You mentioned before having that kind of more curated space, people still really seeming to engage with that. Barnes & Noble, you mentioned before, you know, took their eye off the ball somewhat. They didn't really make the investment in financial terms or just in the culture of their bookstores terms. How important is that? I remember when I was in Portland recently talking to Powell's Books, the celebrated US book outlet, and the store remains at the very heart of everything they do. It's so important, that physical space. Do you think that now some of these other big players will realise that that's an area they just cannot afford to neglect?
I think if you can make the bookshop the theatre for selling physical books, and you can keep the price of those physical books fairly high, so you concentrate on non-fiction or hardback books. And there's a definite move in that direction. People who love books are still buying particularly good quality books at fairly high prices. If you can focus on that and get the curation right, I still think there's a good market for that. Waterstones is proving that. It's investing in its business. It's refitting some of its stores, and where it's done that, where it's made them better and a better experience for customers, is getting sales growth. So they're still there. But you can't ignore the digital business. Digital business will probably be 50% of fiction this year. You might get more customers in store buying more and more expensive books, but it's still going to be a slightly smaller market. And that's the trick that the big booksellers such as Waterstones and Barnes & Noble need to pull off, really.
Absolutely, Philip. I just want to build on that point, because it seems like many bookstores are now, at least in the United States and at least here in London as well, they're taking inspiration from the Japanese model of bookstores, where it very much is a destination shopping. It's somewhere where you're going to spend a day, have a meal, meet a book concierge, go to classes. Is that business model starting to really resonate amongst people here in the West?
I don't think it's happened yet in quite those terms. I think in the UK it's still all about coffee and cafes, and if you go in and you drink a coffee and maybe you buy a book, that's seen as a good experience. I think when through the Waterstones investment in its businesses, and when Foyles, the biggest bookstore still in the UK that moves down Charing Cross Road early next year, I think we will see an introduction of a new style of bookselling that is more about the theatre, more about the rounded shopping experience, and more about selling other things off the platform of the bookshop. And I think that will be really interesting to see whether that can really pay off in the UK.
Excellent stuff. Philip Jones, editor of The Bookseller, many thanks for joining us here on the programme. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York. Because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
The applause of
Bravo,
an audience.
Tom, bravo.
Well, I'm always greeted by that. It's the applause of an audience, of course, at the theatre. Music to the ears of most actors, the seal of approval. On a performance, well done. The ovations, the applause, the adulation. Maybe the goal for many performers, but ask any actor, the road to get there can be less than smooth.
Well, from countless bad auditions to rejection to the criticism and constant attention, if, and that's a big if, you're actually enough to be an actor, it's not easy. Well, one man who is qualified is Michael Simpkins, someone with 35 years behind him from theatre to movies to even radio. Tom, you might need to be worried. Michael is out with a new book titled The Rules of Acting. So for all you aspiring actors out there, time to listen up, and that's including myself in that equation. Michael, many thanks for joining us on the program. A fantastic book, a very fun. Tom and I were cracking up upstairs before the show, just going through it. I want to start, though, with the opening chapter of the book. It's a very funny story. And I've always wanted to say these words on radio. A pig and cocksuck.
Well, I'm glad you said it rather than me. That would have been my career finished. I've written five books now, and there's always a point where you suddenly realize there's a tipping point where you know the book is going to work. And with me, it was going to see a friend of mine for a drink last December in a fashionable hostelry in Soho here in London. And he didn't know I was writing a book, but he just happened to have been working on this film. And he told me a story that was so exquisitely summed up the whole dreadful, garish dilemma of being a jobbing actor that at the end of it, I just said to him, thanks very much. I think you've just got my book for me. And it was really a story he told about having to do a film. It was advertised as filming in San Paolo, a film set in the Spanish Inquisition. It looked like it was going to be lovely. Three weeks in San Paolo. He didn't read the whole script because he had his in-laws there at the weekend. So he just printed off the one speech that he could see his character had to do. He nailed it at the interview. And the director at the end of it said, well, the job's yours. That was fantastic. Are you happy to do it? He said, yes. Director said, did you enjoy the script? My friend, of course, hadn't read the script, but of course it's now too late to say he hasn't read the script, so he said, I think it's wonderful. So he just says, that's wonderful, so you're happy with nudity then? And the actor says, yeah, I'm happy with nudity, because he can't say what nudity, because he's supposed to have read the script. So then the director says, well, it'll be wonderful. He said, I think you'll get on very well with the pig. he said he's a very nice, he's a Gloucester old spot. He answers to the name of Boris, and he's very lovely. So you won't have any trouble in your nude scene with the pig. And then he adds the fatal words, but of course, we don't know how he's going to react when he's sodomized by an actor. So my friend can't back out of it. It turns out it's not filming in San Paolo. It's actually filming in a studio that's in a converted car warehouse in Stevenage.
That's almost as romantic, isn't it?
So my friend has this dreadful scene where he's obviously not quite as explicit as it sounds, but he's playing a cardinal whose enemies have drugged him, and he wakes up finding he's naked and stuck to the back of a pig. And the pig wrangler, as the woman is called, who brings the pig, the pig wrangler says, don't worry, it'll be fine. He says, we're going to put a trough of apples in front of the pig, and Boris will be so busy scoffing the apples that he won't notice that we're filming and that you're stuck to him and doing your scene. He said, mind you, she said, once he's eaten too many apples, it will act as an alcoholic stimulant, and then he will become fractious, in which case he might back out of the stall, and in which case the entire force of the pig will be channeled through his trotters, and he will crush your legs to pulp. So do be a bit careful. That's the story, my friend.
Incredible. The perils of acting, I think that's probably not exactly what people had in mind, but it just kind of represents the unexpected directions, I suppose, yeah, that an acting career can go in. Yeah. I mean, you begin the book that way. You actually end it by looking back at some of your contemporaries from the sort of drama school days and seeing what's become of them and become of their dreams. How much do you think that the world of acting is all about, you know, the few who make it, the many who don't? Is there almost an anticipation when you embark on the journey that so many of those people who have such optimism maybe aren't going to quite make it to the top of the tree?
That's a very good point. I mean, it was Woody Allen who said show business is not so much dog eats dog as dog doesn't return other dog's phone calls. And it's true that 92% of all actors are out of work at any one time. So the trick is to be in the 8%. But the problem is, or the thing that keeps all actors going, despite these stupefying odds, is that narrative always wins out over statistics. And if you want to be an actor and you can't think of any other way to spend your time, you always have this belief that you're going to be one of the few that make it. And it's that keep actors going. And indeed, as you said, a few years ago, a national newspaper asked me to track down my class of 1978. There were 21 of us at RADA, which is arguably the world's top drama school. And they asked me to track down what had happened to them. And just as one of the tutors had predicted in my final weeks of the course back in 1978. He said, within 5 years, there'll be only 10 of you acting. Within 10 years, there'll only be 5 of you acting. And by the turn of the century, there'll barely be a man left standing. And his prediction, I'm afraid, was absolutely correct. There's me, there's Tim Spall, who many of your listeners will know is now a star turner.
Pretty good company.
A terrific actor. He was always the outstanding actor. But apart from me and him and perhaps one or two others, most of them have given up and have vanished without trace. And it was very interesting to hear their stories about, you know, how the business, not so much they gave up the business gave up them.
So for all those aspiring actors out there, how much should they stick to your rules of acting? Should they study it very closely?
Well, the problem with writing what's, hopefully a humorous and very practical guide to acting is that it can come over as very cynical. And that's the last thing I want to try and imbue in the book, because actually I'm still in love with acting, even at the ripe old age of 56. It's still all I really ever want to do, and I'm only ever happy when I'm doing it. So I want to impress that the book is humorous, but it's very practical. And if you stick to it, you will avoid some of the terrible traps that lay in wait. But ultimately, it's a fantastic way of making a living. The one thing, perhaps the final thing I would say on this subject is that when I started out, acting really was a precarious profession. But nowadays, all professions are precarious. Everybody's having to retrain. Jobs are being shed. People are having to start new careers in the middle age. So in a sense, there's no problem now with acting, because it's just like teaching, working in industry. Everybody's hanging onto the cliff face. So if you want to do it, why not give it a go?
Well, that's a very, very good place to end. Michael Simpkins, thanks very much for joining us. The book is called The Rules of Acting. As you can probably tell from our chat there, it's well worth picking up a copy. Michael, thanks very much for joining us. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll check in with our correspondent in Shanghai, have a glance at the day's news agenda in Brazil and head to Munich. But before we get started with all of that, let's hear from Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Tom. Egypt's interim president has named the liberal economist and former finance minister Hazem El Bablawi as prime minister in a transitional government. State TV has announced that United Arab Emirates has offered Egypt $3 billion of support for the economy, with Saudi Arabia approving $5 billion in aid. Officials investigating the Asiana Airlines crash at San Francisco Airport say the pilot saw trouble when the plane was at 500 feet. The National Transportation Safety Board says the pilot realised the Boeing 777 was off-centre and tried to correct its course as it approached the runway. Canadian authorities have opened a criminal investigation into the freight train disaster, which killed at least 15 people in the town of Lac-Mégantic on Saturday. Police say they found evidence to suggest that the train's brakes may have been tampered with while it was at an overnight parking spot. China has warned of a grim outlook for trade after reporting a fall in exports and imports when both had been expected to rise. The data for June showed exports fell 3.1% from a year earlier and imports dropped 0.7%. Italy's highest court has set the 30th of July as the date for hearing the ex-Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's tax fraud appeal, a much earlier date than expected. An appeals court upheld Mr. Berlusconi's conviction in May. It also reinstated a 4-year jail term and 5-year ban from public office. And the British broadcaster Channel 4 has become the first commercially funded public service TV station in Britain to air the Muslim call to prayer every morning during the month of Ramadan. Despite criticism, the channel says it's right to give a voice to the country's Muslim minority, which has faced a backlash since the murder of a soldier on a London street. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Shanghai
to Jakarta
to Moscow
to Los Angeles
to Beijing
to Yokohama to Amsterdam
to Cairo
to Karachi
to Bogota, all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Phil Hahn. In this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs, we visit the kiosks in the Middle East, where class boundaries blur. We'll meet the man who designed a shoe unlike anything else the industry had ever seen, and we'll go behind the scenes at one of the tech world's most advanced research facilities.
But in this preview, we're heading to Germany. Regulating the temperature in our homes and offices is a difficult art. Finding the balance between warm and stuffy, or chilly and fresh, is a tough science. But one German startup is trying to bring new ideas to the heating industry and shake things up a little. And if all goes to plan, the founders of the Munich-based Tado hope to make you realize that heating is much cooler than you think. Jonathan Gifford reports.
It's one of those things that most households have, yet no one really thinks about that much. But maybe more of us should. While there have been a range of innovative products that have changed important aspects of our lives, in parts of the world where winter is relatively long and cold, the vast majority of our heating systems, like in this basement here, have stayed more or less the same. But while it may not be in the forefront of your mind, it does make up a big part of a household's energy consumption, coming in at over one third. Add to the fact that energy from fossil fuels, in most parts of the world at least, hasn't been getting any cheaper. Some entrepreneurs have spotted an opportunity. So that's why, back up on street level, on what turns out to be a pretty hot day in Munich, a company's designed a way to make stupid old heating systems a whole lot smarter.
Otado is basically the first geolocation app for your heating. It helps you to save 27% on average and increases your comfort at the same time.
This is Leopold von Bismarck, the CMO of Otado. He describes the Otado heating control system as a personal assistant to your heating.
The system knows when people leave the house, and when the last resident has left the home, it'll decrease the temperature to save energy. No interaction required, it's all automatic. When the first resident comes back home, it'll preheat the apartment so it's warm when you arrive.
Otado is able to do this by using your smartphone's metadata. The kit itself comprises of an attachment onto your thermostat at home, and an app on your iPhone or smartphone provides the other data Otado needs to know about where you and your other housemates are. But that's not the only data it uses.
Other inputs are weather forecasting data that we use to control the system intelligently. So for example, on a very sunny day, Otado can use this information and decide to heat less because the sun is already warming up the house. And then also Otado gets to know the house really well. So it looks at how fast the house cools down, how fast it heats up. And this information is also used to increase the efficiency further on.
There's another smart heating control system on the market at the moment that learns about your household's energy usage. It's called Nest, but it differs from Otado in that, well, firstly, you can only use it in the US. And secondly, Nest can be a little bit more conservative in that it can take actually hours for it to begin ramping down the heating, while Otado should theoretically be quicker off the mark, meaning more savings. Martin Spindler is a strategy consultant in the area of smart energy and describes the Otado approach as being a genuinely interesting one, not least because through interaction with your heating system in the app, something as essentially boring as heating can actually be fun. But more importantly, the automatic or autonomous functionality, he says, is vital.
I think that's paramount because nobody wants to bother with programming their thermostat. I always compare home automation or heating in general to the blinking 12 on VCRs, as it were. Everybody kind of could program it, but nobody ever bothers because so unintuitive. So anything to automate that is a plus for consumers.
And there are definitely other examples of consumers getting a new gadget, which can save energy and money, and then kind of losing interest over time. To meet this challenge, Otado sends users a monthly report on their energy usage to help them stay closer in touch. And in fact, the startup has chosen to use a monthly payment system for the service, €99 a month, instead of just an upfront purchase of the Otado system. Now, this strategy has drawn some criticism from some reviewers and analysts. For now, Otado says they're sticking with this pricing model, and the system was rolled out in Germany a little over 6 months ago. They report having thousands of customers. And there are plans to roll out the service in other German-speaking countries before elsewhere in Europe.
And so you unbox this just like that, and then you'll find the actual product packaging. That's 100% recyclable as well. And if you open that, you will see the main components of Otado.
One other important thing that Otado is doing to keep users engaged and interested is by being very design conscious. Not only does the online interface, app, and report employ clean, clear, and stylish design, but so also does the Southern Germany-made controlling box and communication device, which is pretty simply wired into the home's thermostat. Founder and CEO Christian Dahlmann says that design was a crucial part of Otado's strategy.
Basically, functional design is the headline, and like all of our products and user interfaces are based on these rules of functional design.
But while the clean, white lines of the hardware are certainly simple, the implications of the technology like Tado certainly aren't. The field is broadly called the Internet of Things, which is kind of defined as everyday objects being equipped with internet connectivity. It's an area where there's a lot of activity taking place right now, and it's also seen the emergence of the smartphone as a kind of remote control for our lives. Consultant Martin Spindler says that while this is certainly an emerging trend, it's also a double-edged sword.
It is something that we will see more of, although I'm kind of split in terms of whether that's actually a good thing, because I think hardware in your home needs to be controlled in your home as well. There always needs to be that button and that control to make it work even without a smartphone. And there's that thing which I fear is that consumers, or rather people, don't know how to control their homes anymore because there's just too many apps to work on.
Spindler says that emerging standards for these kind of controls will help resolve some of the issues, and as more areas of our home open up to remote, wireless, and even autonomous control, a range of issues is certainly being recognized. Tado 2 is looking for the broader application of its technologies and approach into the cooling of our homes and air conditioning, and perhaps even the generation of hot water. For Monocle in Munich, I'm Jonathan Gifford.
And you can hear more reports on entrepreneurship around the world in the latest edition of The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. That's later today at 1900 hours London time here on Monocle 24. Tom, I'm still thinking about Michael Simpkins and the rules of acting.
He was a lot of fun, wasn't he?
It was good fun.
His and book you, really is a terrific read.
And you have some acting genes in your family, don't you?
Not really.
Well, your brother, he was a bit of an actor, wasn't he?
He was quite an accomplished actor.
Peter Crouch lookalike, you said?
Whoa, come on now. He's moved on to greater things.
Okay.
Even greater than the world of treading the boards, Phil. You should have some lofty ambitions of your own.
I do, don't worry.
Well, how long have we got? You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and future Oscar winner Phil Hahn. We'll be checking in with our person in Shanghai right after this.
Join us at midday London time every weekday for The Briefing, Monocle 24's fast-paced hour-long roundup of global breaking news stories, in-studio analysis, and a first look at the North American front pages. And for those waking up on the East Coast, it's the perfect way to get a Monocle take on the stories you need to know at the start of each day. The Briefing, live at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York and 6 a.m. in Chicago.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, our show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes. Oh, and the answers are knit, yes, ask the Japanese, San Francisco, where else, the Caracas poor on the up, and a greener than thou Malmo hood. Urbanist listeners, don't look too smug. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
You're with Midori House. It's 8:43 a.m. here in London. Time to check in with one of our many contributors around the world today. We're speaking with Emily Ford, Monocle's woman in Shanghai, who joins us live on the line now. Emily, thanks very much for joining us, as always, here on Midori House. Now, a little earlier in the show, we were talking about tumbling Chinese exports, the first fall in, well, since the start of last year. But it's been exacerbated, hasn't it, this problem, by an interesting issue involving invoicing. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yes, hello. So this has been a really sort of funny and also slightly worrying story throughout this year. We've had since January, the monthly export and import data from China was showing these really strange fluctuations, these sort of incredible rises, which basically led economists to start questioning whether the numbers were in fact real. Now, this is something that you generally get with all kinds of economic data in China, questions over the credibility, whether it's being stage managed. But these numbers that we were seeing with the export data were so out of whack that the government actually had to admit that there was a serious problem with fake invoices inflating the data beyond the realms of credibility. What seems to have happened is that companies in China and traders were exporting or claiming to be exporting huge amounts of goods to Hong Kong. The reason was that they then benefited from sort of tax rebates by re-importing the goods to China, all kinds of tricky things going on, disguising capital invoices as exports and so on. And this caused a huge problem because essentially the export-import data for the first 5 months of the year has been completely false. And this month we're finally starting to see the true picture, and it's a lot worse than anyone really thought.
So some disappointing economic news there out of China, but some good news if we stick to Shanghai. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's potentially a huge deal. We're still waiting for the details, but basically it's part of the Chinese government's plan to turn Shanghai into a global financial center on the scale of New York or London or Hong Kong. And what we're expecting is to see easing on the restrictions of trading with foreign companies and also liberalizing of the Chinese currency, the yuan, and this is going to be a really big deal if it's rolled out across China, which is what the government is hoping.
And some other good news on that front as well. It looks like they're going to be lifting a 13-year ban on the sale of game consoles. Is this true?
Yes, this is a funny story. So in 2000, the Chinese government took it upon itself to ban the manufacture and sale of games consoles from Sony PlayStation, Nintendo Wii in China because they were worried that these violent video games were going to corrupt the minds of young people in China. Now, more than a decade later, I think they've had to admit that not only is there a huge black market for the consoles here, which means that anyone who wants to get their hands on one can, everybody's also playing games on their iPhones, on their iPads, which they have no control over. So I think this is a pragmatic step by the government to allow games consoles to be made and sold here. But they are saying that any video games will have to pass the censorship department's approval first. So it's not a complete free-for-all.
So that's good news for some young people, certainly in China. But they may be slightly more perturbed by this new law, which suggests that they need to go and visit and call on their elderly parents, or they could be sued. Now, I think we sort of touched upon this story. But there is a serious note, though, isn't there, Emily, to this, which is how the country deals with what is going to be an absolutely enormous crisis, almost, in terms of an imbalanced population with huge numbers of elderly people, what, within a generation?
Sure. I mean, the experts talk about it as a demographic time bomb. We've got 185 million people over 60 in China at the moment. This is going to double in the next 15 to 20 years. And there's just not enough young people to support them. The one-child policy means that there's one child for two parents and four grandparents. And with people moving to cities to work, they just can't go home that often. And so you've got huge numbers of elderly people who are, on their own. Many are in poor health, bad financial situation, depressed. And so the government's introduced this new law which says that, children have to call their parents and visit them regularly. Otherwise, their parents can sue them, can take them to court. And it's quite a striking move, I think.
Well, thanks very much, Emily. I personally think it's a great idea. Reach out to your parents every day. Why not? It just takes a phone call, a couple seconds a day. I do it.
You're such a great guy, Phil.
Thank you. That was Emily Ford, Monocle's regular contributor in Shanghai. Thanks very much for joining us here on the program. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
We're going to be glancing through the front pages in Brazil in just a moment, but let's get some music from there to take us to those papers. This is Fresh Beats by Mahandas with Saudade Stopara.
Ai que saudade que eu tenho lá do Pará, das coisas boas que só tem por lá. Ai que saudade que eu tenho lá do Pará,
And that was Hajujash Dupara by Mohandas, Longing for the State of Para.
Well, you're with Midori House here, with me, Tom Edwards, and Phil Hahn. Sorry, I've been slightly taken aback. We're joined by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, now, just before we talk about the newspapers, let's talk about that song, Shadadesh Dupara.
It's a lovely song.
It's longing for the state of Para, you explained.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, Para is a state in the north of Brazil, you know, and that's where the Amazon forest is. And actually, there's a great music scene at the moment in the state of Para. Even one of my favorite singers, Gabi Amarantos, is from there, this lovely band, Mohandas, which uses some music from there, like Caribó, with some more electro beats, you know. So I'm sure they don't live in Para anymore, but they have this longing for Para. And Brazilians, they all have saudades. I have saudades of São Paulo. It's a very common word. I think it only exists in Portuguese.
It's a nice word, isn't it? Longing for something.
It's very, yeah. Hmm. It's kind of poetic.
Yeah.
It's almost beautiful.
We're very poetic, actually.
Lovely stuff.
And beautiful.
Let's talk about the newspapers. I don't know, there may be some beautiful stories, maybe some poetry in here. Where should we start, Fernando, with today's review?
Today, actually, there's a lot of nice stories. There's not too much about protest economy. Funnily enough, the front page of Folha de São Paulo is about something very particular of Brazil. You know, it's saying that the Brazilian Congress, they finally approved yesterday that they're going to restrict discounted tickets to cultural events. I discussed this before on the radio when this was just a project, but now it's finally approved. And you wonder, why this is so big, such big news? You know, because basically, sometimes some events, 70% of the tickets are sold as discounted prices. Because if you're a student in Brazil, or if you're an elderly person, you pay half price. And some people, let's be honest, even if they're not students, they pretend they're students. So they have like a fake...
You wouldn't do that, would you, Fernando?
Never. Good, never.
But surely this must be a good way to encourage young people to enjoy cultural events across the country?
That's the trick part, Phil. Because of that, the tickets for concerts or cinemas, they become very, very expensive. You know, to go to a concert in Brazil is more expensive than here in Europe or in the US. So it becomes prohibitively expensive. You know, so, and then the artists, they were not happy with that as well. You know, sometimes some events, if 70% of the tickets are sold as discounted price, they wouldn't get a profit as well. So I think it's a good decision. And they're going to limit that to 40%. So after 40% has been reached, they're not going to sell half price anymore, even if you're a student.
So there's a bit of a row about pricing, but it's not stopped a huge boom, certainly in going to the movies, because Brazilian cinema, well, the figures are almost unbelievably good, aren't they?
Exactly. The first semester this year, I mean, another story from Folha de São Paulo. The public for Brazilian films rose by 280% comparing to last year. I have to say, I mean, last year it was not like a vintage year for films, but it still is an enormous growth. And you may wonder, what do Brazilians like to watch? You know, I was watching the top five. Basically, we like comedies and biographies of a musician, Renato Russo. Because there's three comedies on the top five and two biographies of the same singer.
Wow.
I mean, he's iconic. He died from AIDS in the 90s. He was like a wonderful poet. Actually, maybe in my next newspaper review, we're going to play a song from Renato Russo.
We should, yeah.
Yeah, we should. And the first film is called De Pernas para o Ar. Dois, which is the Pernas para o Ar 2. I saw the first one. It's quite a funny film. It's about a story about a woman, a very successful businesswoman. She lost her job. She gets very depressed. But then she has a great idea to open a sex shop with a friend.
Oh my.
And then she does extremely well. And then number two, which I saw the trailer, I'm very curious to see, she branches to New York.
Well, so Brazilian film's doing very well, 280% growth compared to last year. Are Brazilians in love with Hollywood films then?
Well, funnily enough, not this year. There was a drop in 13% of the public for Hollywood films. And then I was reading the article saying, why, the Confederations Cup plus the protests. But that didn't affect the Brazilian films. So
interesting. Well, maybe we'll try and figure that out for next time, Fernando.
Exactly.
Let's talk about O Globo today. What have we got? What have we got making the front page there?
There was an interesting headline here on Globo saying that our health minister, Alexandre Padilha, he's hunting doctors in Spain. You know, well, I'm going to give the background for that, you know, because Dilma Rousseff, one of her big announcements over the last days that she's going to bring foreign doctors to Brazil to work in the poorest areas because we don't have like enough qualified doctors yet. So, but there was a problem here. And actually, Alexandre Padilha is going to Spain to look for qualified doctors. And, you know, when they speak Spanish, and I think he might go to Portugal as well. So this language thing might help that. But there was a tingle of xenophobia from our own Brazilian doctors saying, how the government can bring foreigners? What about us? You know, there's not enough dialogue. But I think we should, you know. We live in a globalized world, and I think this can certainly help. There was even some discussion that the Brazilian government should bring Cuban doctors. But because of the situation in Cuba, you know, relating to human rights, you know, our press didn't like that story that well. So they said, okay, let's give priority to doctors from Spain and Portugal, which is similar language, but, you know.
And Fernando, I think we have time for maybe just one more quick story as well.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing. You know, we had this huge stadium, Mané Garrincha, in Brasília, right? And people say it's like a white elephant because, I mean, Brazil is not such a big city for such a huge stadium. Mm. But I think they found a solution. So all the teams, well, not all of them, some of the matches from Rio teams, they're going to be played in Brasília. Mm. And actually it's making quite a lot of money for them as well. And it's interesting to note because Brazilians outside Rio, they tend to like the football teams from Rio, like Flamengo. And funnily enough, not so much the São Paulo ones, even though we have the biggest championship in Brazil. That's interesting.
It is interesting, Fernando. Of course, you know, I'm a big fan of Corinthians in Sao Paulo.
Oh, I'm glad.
Because their best, well, possibly their best player, Paulinho. Do you know where he's coming?
He's coming to your country, yeah.
Tottenham Hotspur, right here in London town.
Don't steal more, Tom, please.
I'm hoping that more and more. A whole Brazilian, a whole Samba team. Yeah. Samba comes to N17. That could be what happens. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us to run through the newspapers today. It was lots of fun, as always. That's almost all we've got time for today's show. Thanks to our producer, Thomas Lewis, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and of course, Tess McCann, and our studio manager, Samantha the Lily White MP. Up next after the news is The Menu with Marcus Hippi.
And I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds for tomorrow's edition of Mindori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Tom Edwards, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.